So, it's now my very great pleasure to introduce the Honourable Chris Finlayson, when I can find the quick notes I made. Chris is a Wellington boy. I won't tell you when he was born. He can do that himself if he wants to. He has a Master of Laws from Victoria University of Wellington. He practiced as a lawyer, I take it as a barrister and solicitor, for 25 years. He became an MP in 2005, and of course he became Attorney General in 2008. So without further ado, it's my very great pleasure to introduce Honourable Chris Finlayson.
Thank you, Frank. It's nice to see you again. It's, you can take all your rubbish. It's great to be here. I must say I thought I'd be addressing a whole lot of Farrah-type hobbits, but you will look reasonably normal, so it's especially pleasant to be here. And it's great to see you back in the country, Farrah. I am an inveterate reader of Farrah's blog, and I've been following with great interest, David, your trips through Egypt and Jordan and across to Israel and Iran. I'd be very interested at some stage to know what your treatment at Tel Aviv Airport was when you arrived from Iran, but that would be for another day. So this is a very important seminar, and you've got a very high quality lineup ahead of you. I'm just sorry I can't stay for the whole day, but before I begin, let me say I'm more than happy to make copies of my remarks available. I certainly don't want to suffer another accusation on Claire Curran's blog that I don't write my own material. If they're here, I'd like to acknowledge the presence of Claire from the Labour Party and David Clendon, who's David, are you here? New MP from the Green Party, or he'll be here at some stage. There's no question that the internet poses challenge to the law. That's the statement of the obvious. In fact, technology's moving so fast that I now even have a Twitter page, and this week's New Zealand lawyer devoted a whole page to the question of whether lawyers should be allowed to tweet from court. One Federal Court of Australia judge has allowed tweeting in his court, saying that on the basis that twittering does not distract or interfere with the conduct of my court, I personally have no objection to its use. I believe the public has a legitimate right to be fully informed of proceedings, particularly proceedings which have attracted considerable public interest. And His Honour went on to say that twittering can serve to inform the public in a more speedy and comprehensive manner than may be thought possible through traditional media coverage. And I agree with that, but I think obviously we need to tread very carefully indeed. It's impossible for the law to keep up with the rapid rate of technological development, and I suppose that's relevant, Frank, not only in relation to contempt but also copyright. So we have to do our best to adapt to the conditions and perhaps even alter our views on some matters. The government is very interested in the issue of contempt. I have a particular interest in it and will shortly be making an announcement on the subject. That's all I can really say about that for now. The essential characteristic of contempt is conduct that obstructs, prejudices, or otherwise interferes with the administration of justice. And this may apply to a particular case or more generally, and it's my role to take a lead in this branch of the law. The wide range of behaviour covered by the word contempt includes disobedience to court orders, contemptuous conduct in the face of the court, reprisals or the intimidation of witnesses or parties to a suit, and conduct out of court aimed at interfering with the course of justice in particular proceedings. A fellow called J.L. Edwards wrote an excellent book called The Attorney General, Politics and the Public Interest. And as he said in that book, it's with the last of these categories that attorneys general have become involved in recent years and have in turn been praised or condemned for their intervention. Some of the criticism derives from a misconception of the term contempt of court, it often being thought that it's got something to do with protecting the dignity of judges or those who are associated with the smooth functioning of the court. Lord President Clyde and Johnston and Grant described this as a petty and misleading interpretation which missed the core essentials of the law of contempt. He maintained that the offence of contempt challenged the fundamental supremacy of the law, and I particularly like that phrase. Contempt of court is not just about displaying a lack of decorum in front of a judge. In fact, I don't think courts can be too precious about contempt. It's sometimes very easy for a court to be impressed by its own status. I recall a book which many of you would know called Miscellany at Law, published by a former English judge, Sir Robert McGarry. He told the story of a litigant who in 1631 threw a brickbat at a judge but missed, had his right hand chopped off and nailed to a gibbet on which he was thereafter hanged in the presence of the court. As many people have said over the years, one wonders what would have happened to the miscreant had his aim been better. As one commentator noted, only Vlad the Impaler would not have been impressed. There's another story of a litigant removing a dead cat from a paper parcel and hurling it inaccurately at a county court judge who remarked, "I shall commit you for contempt if you do that again." The incident is recorded in the index of McGarry's book in a hilarious way as contempt of court - dead cat - one throw allowed - two throws contempt. So I agree that the phrase contempt of court is outdated. I agree with Lord Scammon that it's high time we arranged our law so that the ancient but misleading term contempt of court disappeared from the law's vocabulary. Contempt of court is not just about displaying that lack of decorum in front of a judge, but it's concerned to ensure that the courts function without being subjected to extraneous pressures that might imperil the impartial and objective determination of the issues. As I must interpolate and say that as we look at the law of contempt, it makes one realise how extraordinarily lucky we are in New Zealand to have as the Dean of Victoria's Law Faculty, Professor Tony Smith. Many of you will know of that excellent text from the sort of the Chitty on Contracts, Trital on Tort Library, Arledge, Smith and Edie on the law of contempt. Professor Smith has been the key author with Justice Edie of that text for many years. So we're very lucky to have you here for all your other qualities, Professor Smith, but particularly because you know the subject so well. And if I can, a further interpolation, and I wouldn't dare mention his name, there's a wonderful story of many years ago, the then Sir Robin Cook and Pat Downey from Butterworths were trying to work out who could write the Laws of New Zealand chapter on the law of contempt. And Cooks said, give it to XYZ because he's committed most of it. And I certainly will not be giving you his name. But some of you here will be able to deduce who exactly I'm talking about. In our times, the rule of law may still be damaged by bricks being thrown at judges, but it's certainly damaged if people are able to download confidential information about judges and reveal their home addresses on websites. It's damaged if suppressed judgments are made available on blogs. It's damaged if people with name suppression can be identified. A person uploading thousands of pages of suppressed information to a website does not aid the rule of law. Neither do internet campaigns set up in an attempt to influence juries. How we can most effectively deal with such cases is a very interesting question. As some, of course, have suggested, we just simply can't deal with the cases. Some contend that name suppression has become an irrelevancy in the internet age. It's a well-established principle that the courts will not lend their efforts to a futility. The internet has brought this problem to the fore and has greatly enlarged the number of situations in which the courts cannot reasonably act as the horse has already bolted. My only experience and practice of the perils of the internet was a case called the Attorney General for England and Wales and Tomlinson when I was acting for the attorney. Tomlinson had been an employee on probation in the British SIS, but he was subsequently dismissed from the SIS and he commenced proceedings for unfair dismissal and started to breach the UK Official Secrets Act, so he ended up for a period in Wormwood Scrubs. He was then released from prison, went to Paris and flew to New Zealand. He had grown up, I think, in Narawahia, and he was served with an injunction the morning he arrived from the flight from Tokyo, and it prevented him from disclosing any information obtained in the course of his employment with the SIS. He didn't file a defence within the time for filing, but left the country, and he also had sworn but didn't file an affidavit protesting the jurisdiction of the court. Then a few weeks later, articles were published in London, and I think there are also a couple in the Women's Weekly here. He also uploaded the names of various alleged agents onto the internet, and every time I think they tried to shut down one site, he'd pop up and say, "You can't get me, I've started a new site." And then a couple of months later in Moscow, I think it was, he published his book, which could be described as more faction than fiction, but it referred to certain events that were vaguely true. He published that book, and 2 months later he then filed an application in the New Zealand courts recording an appearance and a protest, and also sought an enlargement of time in which to file the statement of defence. The court was satisfied that he was in contempt of the injunction. Justice Gendel said the order and the defendant's actions went to the very heart of the litigation and the actual relief sought. Defiance of the interim order denied the process of justice, as it rendered nugatory the purpose of the substantive hearing. And so the judge basically said that any litigant who sought the indulgence of the court, as Tomlinson was doing in seeking an enlargement of time, had to obey the court's orders. So his application to enlarge time was stayed until such time as the defendant submitted himself to the examination of the court. The stay was to operate for a maximum of 40 days, at the expiration of which the application would be dismissed. And, of course, he never returned. I think he's still on a yacht in Antibes, suggesting that the Duke of Edinburgh murdered Princess Diana. So it was an obvious case of contempt, where the court was able to act decisively. In other cases, resolution is not that straightforward. I recently had a chance to discuss some of these issues at a meeting with some attorneys general in London last month. Earlier this year, the English Attorney General Baroness Scotland visited New Zealand, and I had a chat with her. She raised the idea at that meeting that a meeting of the Attorneys General of New Zealand, England and Wales, Australia, Canada and the US might be useful. And true to her word, she arranged the meeting, and we met at Lancaster House about 3 weeks ago. Each attorney presented a paper on a topic of mutual interest to our five countries and resolved to report back on progress later in the year. I spoke about how our countries can cooperate in the prosecution of those responsible for genocide, but also contributed to a paper presented by Baroness Scotland called Striking the Right Balance, Freedom of Speech and Radicalisation in the Internet Age. The paper dealt with a range of issues, including child pornography and contempt of court. So what you're about to discuss today is an extraordinarily important contemporary issue. I emphasise I'm not worried about respect for courts just to make judges feel good. My concern is to ensure that the courts can function, and I have an overriding responsibility to ensure that the rule of law is upheld. And that is why I think these issues warrant careful consideration, and why I congratulate the Internet Society and the Law Commission and the Ministry of Justice for facilitating this important conference. And I very much look forward, Farah, to reading about the rest of today's proceedings on KiwiBlog. Dean tells me that Tomlinson was a student at Gonville and Keyes. So there you go, small world.
thank you, Chris. That's given us an excellent start to our proceedings, sets the scene very nicely.